This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Next month, there will be a huge chess tournament for students at historically black colleges and universities to broaden the appeal of the game. It's being organized by chess grandmaster Maurice Ashley. And tell us your story. How were you introduced to chess and how did you become a grandmaster?
Well, thanks very much for having me, for sure. And let me just say, I was introduced to chess in a way that you don't want to be introduced, by getting my butt kicked in high school. And that is on the chessboard. A friend of mine was playing chess. I knew the rules. He knew a bit more than the rules. And so I learned the hard way. But thankfully, I saw a book in the library. Didn't know there were chess books. That was it. Started a love affair with the game. There were so many ideas and strategies and tactics, and I just ate them all up. That had me reading not just that book, but literally scores of other books. And then I started playing chess in the parks, chess in the clubs, found out that there were things like masters and international masters and grandmasters, and played in those competitions. Eventually, it took me years, 19 years after I first started, in fact, to become an international ranked player, getting the title of grandmaster.
That is impressive. So it sounds like you were lucky that a friend introduced you and it clicked with you, but you're hosting this event because you want more black players in the game. Why do you think it is not as diverse as it should be?
Well, I think a lot of people just don't have access and realize that this game is this great game that it is. You see a lot of young kids, African-American kids, to be frank, playing the game as now they're introducing it more and more into the school system. People recognize that the game helps with all these kinds of skills that you want kids to have: critical thinking, problem solving, goal setting, certainly planning ahead, concentration, focus. And that's definitely happening. We'll see programs all over the country, New York, Atlanta. You see it in Houston, LA, Detroit, Chicago. So it's definitely been building as a movement. You don't see it at the collegiate level, however. Kids kind of fall off because there's not a lot of money in chess and they go different ways. But we definitely want to see the collegiate ranks pick it up as well. And so we're starting this tournament, HBCU Chess Classic, the first of its kind, April 22nd in Atlanta. Great schools coming: Hampton, Howard, Morehouse, Clark, Spelman, FAMU. It's just amazing to have all these schools there as we celebrate the game in a diverse space. So we can have all these kids, not just at those schools, but all 107 HBCUs is the vision coming in the future.
All I know about chess is from binge watching Gambit. So, and I've never interviewed a grandmaster before. So I need to ask you, number one, is grandmaster status something anybody can achieve with enough work, or do you have to be somehow gifted to get there? Have that, because you, as you mentioned, the person who first beat you and what kicked your butt, he knew the rules, but he had to have something extra too, right?
Well, he had read a bunch of books. Let's get it straight. he had studied, he had played already, he had experience in the game, and eventually, I actually passed him and became a better player. Because there was something in my brain that tilted chess, mm-hmm. right? There's something I just got. I could see the patterns quickly. I could memorize things easily when you told them to me at the board. And soon I even learned that I could play chess blindfolded. Like, I didn't need to see the board. I could actually just see it in my mind and play. And I've even played multiple games at the same time blindfolded. I've played as many as 10 games blindfolded simultaneously. So yeah, to have your brain kind of work a certain way, there is such a thing as chess talent. I think hard work also is a talent. So you see grandmasters do that, have that talent as well, to really spend hours and hours working on the game. But you're right, it's not just everybody who's going to become a grandmaster, but everybody can learn and benefit from the game.
So something has to click, because you probably saw Gambit. The way they depicted it was when she was thinking about her next move, she could see in her head chess pieces rapidly moving around. So is that what happens to you? You just see it and instantly you know what to do?
Yes. Just every grandmaster can do that. Even lower ranked than grandmasters are capable of doing that. I can see multiple games at the same time. I used to actually dream chess positions and chess games. Uh-huh. I really hated those dreams because somehow I always lost in my dreams, which sucked. But yes, there is just something that clicks for talented youngsters, the people who have chess talent, that is, and we just able to see the board in our minds and able to play and see oftentimes many moves ahead when we're playing.
That's incredible. And as a mother of a 4-year-old and almost 10-year-old, I'm thinking, okay, are there any special skills or signs I should be looking for in my children that shows me chess may click with them? Was there anything for you as a child that indicated you could play chess?
Remember, I was a teenager when I picked it up. I was already 14 years old. I was pretty good at in school, you know, pretty good at math. But I was also someone who loved to solve puzzles. Mm. I would do any puzzle you put in front of me, crossword puzzles or word search or you name it, anything that had a puzzle element to it, I always loved to do. And you could tell those kinds of kids who love to solve things, and that is always a sign. You could tell the kind of kid who will get good at chess pretty quickly. But you'll be surprised. There are kids you think, that kid's never going to learn chess. Like, and they'll be great at it. You see athletes, for example, sure. People think of them as like dumb jocks.
No.
And you can't imagine how many football players love chess, basketball players love chess, and are extremely good.
Chess Grandmaster Maurice Ashley organizing the first of its kind chess tournament for historically black colleges and universities, which will be coming to Atlanta in April. Maurice, thank you very much for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me. And if you want to learn more, go to uschesschamps.com.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. My gundamentalist friends will tell you that you can't blame the gun for these mass shootings. But there's an article in the Texas Tribune which shows that there is something especially ominous about the what is too often the gun of choice, the AR-15, that it is so deadly it even terrifies responding police officers, and that it may be the reason that police hesitated to enter that classroom in Uvalde. Zach Despart wrote the article about this. And Zach, you based this on interviews with the responding police officers in Uvalde?
Yes, we obtained from a confidential source the investigative interviews that the responding police gave with investigators in the days after the shooting.
And what did they say?
We focused in particular, because as your listeners know, there were several hundred police ultimately responded to the shooting. We focused on the interviews of the initial 6, 7, 8 officers who were the first ones into the school. And they all said, in separate interviews, that once they learned that the gunman had an AR-15 style rifle, that is when they decided that they were not going to immediately go into the classroom and confront the gunman, as the active shooter protocol states. They had cited several times the ability of that rifle, like most rifles, to penetrate the body armor they were wearing at the time. And they concluded that they would likely be killed if they attempted to confront the gunman then.
And it sounds like they would have rather waited. How long did it take for SWAT and backup to show up?
So, I mean, there was backup there, pretty immediately. But consequentially, those initial officers decided to wait for the arrival of a Border Patrol SWAT team to confront the shooter. That SWAT team is based about 60 miles away on the actual U.S.-Mexico border. So it took them to arrive and assemble another 45 minutes.
I still don't understand that. And I suppose that's why your article is so intriguing, because it lets us into the mental state of the officers and their thoughts on the AR-15 in that moment. But even so, when you're standing there for an hour and there are children inside dying, did you get any indication from those interviews if they felt that mental strain of, but I really want to go in there?
I mean, certainly, like, being in any sort of armed confrontation or gunfight, like, places an incredible amount of stress on the body. And we talked to some police experts about that. And, it slows your critical thinking. It slows your ability to really act decisively. Mm. It really reinforces the importance of training for this kind of thing. And the problem is, because mass shootings happen at random times in random places we can't, and this is from what the police expert said, we can't guarantee that the first officers who are going to respond are going to be, have that intense training to be able to respond to what happened. And what you saw in Uvalde was the officers let the gunman's use of an AR-15, they let that derail their response and delay them from acting.
And it sounds like they weren't alone in Uvalde, that this was the mentality of law enforcement at other school shootings as well.
Yeah, that's a good point that we wanted to talk about in the story, where the history of police confronting mass shooters with AR-15s is inconsistent. In some cases, they do it very well. They confront the shooter, even though some of them are killed in this process. In other cases, we had cited the Pulse nightclub shooting and the Parkland High School shooting, both in Florida, of examples where the initial police hesitated. And it's important to talk about, like, it's the initial police, because these shootings happen so quickly. And in this case in Uvalde, the gunman killed most of the victims before the police even arrived, that any hesitation at all is really consequential against this kind of rifle.
Now, gun rights supporters are quick to criticize anybody who would say that the AR-15 is a special or monstrous weapon. They point out that it is a very common weapon, that it's great for hunting, and that what you're doing, quite frankly, is unfair to the gun. So explain what you find to be so horrible about the AR-15 in contrast to other firearms.
So what makes the AR-15 uniquely useful? I know that's a horrible word, but in the context of it being used in a mass shooting, are the same reasons why the military adopted AR-15 style rifles as their principal battle rifle, right? Compared to other hunting rifles, it has a rather like medium-sized caliber. There are many, many larger rifles. When we're talking about a rifle like the AR-15, we're talking about its high-velocity rounds. We're talking about its lightweight, its ease of use, its rapid rate of fire, it's easy to reload. All of those factors together are what make it a particularly lethal weapon on the battlefield and in mass shootings. And an important point to note is, in the civilian version, can fire only semi-automatically. And the point we make in the story is, in the context of mass shootings, this is a distinction without a meaningful difference. And what I mean by that is, both rates of fire are sufficient to kill a room full of people very quickly.
So there is no practical difference then between it. You're saying this, we have every right to call
machine.
This a military rifle. Yeah.
It is undoubtedly a rifle that was originally designed for military use, and that the fact that the civilian version can fire only semi-automatically does not make a huge difference in the context of mass shootings. You had mentioned the fact that the rifle, the AR-15, can be used in hunting, and that's absolutely true. You could use, and many hunters do use the rifle for smaller game. But it's important to note that that was not its initial design purpose.
The design purpose was for killing people in the military.
But what does this lead to? So is this part of an argument that it's time to, well, confiscate these things because they have no business being in private hands?
So I talked to some of the Uvalde victims' families about this particular issue. And I talked to one girl's father, she survived, who had said, he's a former Marine, that he has no objection to civilians owning rifles like the AR-15, but he wants them to have the intense, rigorous training that soldiers do before they're allowed to use the rifle. And I talked to another uncle of a girl who was unfortunately killed, and he said that, you know, the evidence that the findings we have in the story about the police reaction to the AR-15, you know, he thinks like this is blindingly obvious that we should restrict access to this type of rifle.
And in part two of our conversation with Texas Tribune reporter Zach Despart, we're going to talk more about the newsroom's decision not to publish his newsroom's decision not to publish the scenes from the classroom, and whether that was the right call. That's coming up at 8:15 this morning. Choke Points,
let's go.
Brought to you by Acton's Quality Roofing. Washington lawmakers still don't have a solid plan for updating the state ferry system. So what's going to happen? Let's go to Cairo News Radio's Chris Sullivan.
And as we know, the ferry fleet is very old and the boats get knocked out of service for mechanical issues all the time. It needs new boats desperately. Jake Fye is the head of the House Transportation Committee.
To state the obvious, we have... crisis might not be the right word, but it's, I think it's a borderline crisis.
The state has been trying to get five new Olympic-class electric hybrid boats built and delivered for a couple of years now. But the contract from the state shipbuilder, Vigor, came in way over budget, and the deal was scuttled last year. Under current law, any new ferries must be built in Washington State unless all the bids come in 5 to 10% over budget. Then they can go shopping elsewhere. But right now, the lawmakers in the House and Senate are considering a bill that would remove the build in Washington requirement altogether. Gordon Baxter represents the Puget Sound Metals Trade Council, and he reminded lawmakers just how important this industry is to the state.
We ask that you not build these boats at the expense of the workforce or businesses of Washington State due to choices we have made to make Washington a better place to do business, live, and work.
Many shipbuilders around the United States do not have the same environmental rules and protections around the industry that we do in Washington. Our state also has higher wage requirements for workers. So those factors routinely make Washington-built boats or ferries much more expensive. Jeff DeVere represents Nichols Brothers Boat Builders.
We're hoping that we can account for those differences to make sure that these boats are built properly, that they're built with a skilled workforce, and that skilled workforce is paid commensurate to the hard work that it takes to build these.
But there are plenty of people who just want new boats built and want them in service as quickly as possible. Tom Tiersch is the chair of the Ferry Advisory Committee in Jefferson County.
In my 16 plus years on our committee, I've seen Washington State Ferries spend an enormous amount of money to build ferries. Sadly, much of that money has been wasted because ferries has been forced to pay more than any other ferry system to build the boats.
He believes it's time to get rid of the build in Washington requirement.
Studies have shown that the build in Washington mandate has and will increase the cost per boat by about 50% while being of little, if any, long-term benefit to our state. Overly subsidizing shipbuilders in Washington is simply not worth it.
The long-range ferry plan is to have 16 new boats in the fleet by 2040. The $1 billion for the five electric hybrid 144-car boats has already been earmarked in that 2022 transportation package. And again, it's out for bid right now. The question is, can they start by looking out of state? There are 21 ferries in service today. The newest, the Suquamish, was built in 2018. The oldest, the Tillicum, was built in 1959. And a pretty significant number of them were built originally in the late 50s. Yeah. 60s, 70s, and so they really need some work.
How do these shipyards stay in business? Do they rely just on state business because the state has to follow the rules? I mean, who would do business with a shipbuilder whose costs are, you said, 50% at one point?
Yeah, at least according to some estimates. And again, it's about, you know the people you've worked for. You've known these shipbuilders for a long time. I mean, Vigor is the new name for Todd Shipyards, who we've been familiar with for years. I mean, these are people that have done this work. They're familiar with the people in the industry, and so that there might be a familiarity with doing it here, because obviously you get good, high-paying union jobs to do some of this work. But there are fewer and fewer people who do this work here because they are being underbid, certainly from places around the country, certainly the Gulf. But then, of course, if you build something there, you have to get it here, right? So there's costs associated with transferring and things. But yeah, it's an interesting debate, between, the core, kind of the core values of the state versus actually getting something done and addressing the issue.
And now, latest on the police pursuit bill in the legislature, let's go to Cairo News Radio's Matt Markovich. The accusations were flying, so update us on this story, Matt.
Well, good morning, Dave. I apologize for my voice. I got that bug that's going around here. So, how about that? That pursuit bill, like you said, doesn't seem to go away in terms of the headlines. It's probably become the most controversial bill so far this legislative session. And we've learned now that the Democrats, just to give you a brief recap, it was in the Senate, they passed it, they went to the House, they have to vote on it. And now we just learned that the Democratic leadership in the House won't put it to a public hearing. They're not going to let the public testify for and against it. They're going to go right to what's known as executive session on Tuesday and most likely vote it out of committee. So it could go to the floor vote, but doesn't guarantee it. But yeah, the what happened is that you have first term Democratic Representative Julia Reed said during a town hall in the 36th district that Democrats looking to change the bill are lying to the public.
So Democrats are leading this rollback. I think it's really unconscionable. And I think it's unconscionable because, frankly, I think people are being lied to. They are being fed misinformation.
Okay, lying about what?
About the facts of the particular bill that, like, what the police are saying, they can't pursue this particular case. They can't pursue another thing. I'm going to talk about that in a second.
All right.
But I use this as an example among the dissension among the Democrats. Now, I think by having a first-term Democrat representative saying, and she said multiple times, lying, use the word lying, I think she may get a call from the principal, which is Speaker Jenkins, that, you know, ma'am, we don't do that kind of thing here. Call out your fellow Democrats. You can call the Republicans, which she did. But she went on to express disappointment with her fellow Democrats in that same hearing.
And not only is this a top priority for Republicans, but I see so many of my Democratic colleagues buying into it. And that's been really quite personally painful for me.
So the Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs just sent a letter to the members of the House outlining the type of pursuits they could not do under the current bill that's before the House. Now, there were 35 of them, uh-huh, nearly all felonies. And the language that they used was they remain, quote, categorically ineligible for pursuit no matter what the circumstances are. And here's the one that I found was really surprising. They say a person who is involved in a vehicular collision resulting in the death of another and flees the scene. That is a hit and run, a classic hit and run that involves a death. Mm-hmm. And the association is saying they can't chase somebody under that circumstance. They can't chase an adult who assaults a child under the age of 13 with a weapon. And the real basic one, someone who makes a motor vehicle theft, they can't chase them.
So that's the thing that's being lied about here?
Well, that's what people are saying. I'm just quoting what the police association...
So Democrats are saying that, in fact, the police are wrong? They could chase in those cases or not?
Well, I mean, she might be alleging, people might be alleging that the police can do that. Now, if they have probable cause, they can't do this kind of stuff. It's reasonable suspicion, and that's a whole other definition about when they can and cannot chase. Reasonable suspicion is a lower standard in a chase. Probable cause is a higher standard, and they could chase someone with a hit and run if they have certain facts and evidence in that situation. So it's a gray area. Wow. That a lot of the common person doesn't understand so much, and so Democrats are accusing.
Well, what the common person wants is for car thieves to be held accountable.
Now, correct.
And I think the common person also expects that there be professionalism exercised in chases. And so I guess I have to ask you, you've got more experience in this than I do. Can cops be trusted to use proper judgment such that the chase doesn't kill innocent people? That's what we're after here, isn't it?
Correct. You are. You're absolutely right. And they're supposed to be trained professionals and know when to have a chase and when not to. And as you know, a lot of police agencies are calling off the chases unless it's a really dire situation, yeah, because of the liability if somebody does get hit. But again, the misnomer that people are saying is that the rise in crime that we're experiencing is one of the results of not being able to chase criminals.
Yeah.
And there's the evidence of that is unclear.
All right, let's talk about the latest gun legislation that's passed.
So this is a gun restoration bill. Let me just start this is about adding more crimes to have your guns taken away from you. And here's Jolene Joseph. She told her story about what happened to her.
In 2010, my then husband beat and strangled me unconscious as I was packing to move out. He used a gun to dissuade me from calling 911. I called anyway. A year later, without notice to me, he was permitted the restoration of his 24 firearms. He was a former police officer. Within months of the return of these guns, he beat and then shot me at close range with his 45 caliber pistol. They took 2 weeks to remove the 23 other firearms.
Holy cow!
So that's what we're talking about here, in that the bill gives the victim the kind of a notification or some authority to say, hey, you can't give this guy's guns back. Given that with the situation,
hope this guy's in jail now, is he?
I don't know about that particular situation. I'm sorry about that. But what this also does, and here's a real controversial part, it adds more crimes if you're charged with certain crimes and they could come and take away your guns right away, even if you're charged and not convicted. And that mm-hmm. includes domestic violence, which maybe that should be, stalking, cyber stalking, discharging a firearm, unlawful carrying a firearm. And here's one, animal cruelty in the second degree and DUI. So if you're charged with a DUI, mm-hmm. there can be made a case that they come and you have guns that have nothing to do with the DUI. They can come and take your guns. That's part of this law.
Well, I got no problem with that. Only the most upstanding citizens in society should be given the power to quickly kill people, it seems to me.
So, and I'm going to move on to the other bill that you want to you wanted to talk about, which is outlawing these pill machines that create fentanyl. And this is not really that controversial, but it's a law that, you know, people basically, it's creating a Class C felony for any person to possess, purchase, or sell a tableting machine or encapsulating machine, knowing that it'll be used to manufacture controlled substance like fentanyl, and cannabis is excluded. It's called the Tyler Lee Yates Act, and Yates was an acquaintance of Republican Representative Dan Griffey. And Yates, they suffered a motorcycle accident 3 years ago and has been dealing with chronic pain.
Finding a way for Tyler to deal with that chronic pain has been pretty miserable for him. So he turned to the black market to buy Percocets. And he knew it was going to be Percocet because there's an FDA number and markings on this tablet. Tyler bought what he thought was Percocet. Tyler took that pill and we watched Tyler slowly go unconscious and die on camera at a local Indian casino.
Just to be clear, these pill machines can create counterfeit pills which look exactly like the real thing, correct?
Right. You know, the M30. You know, which is a fentanyl pill, which is actually illegal. Fentanyl is legal. It's a prescription drug.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're produced in Mexico with all these things. Now, basically, this bill would outlaw these machines, which are legal. You know, I mean, compounding pharmacies use them to create pills. But when it's associated with an illegal drug like fentanyl and it's in possession, it makes it a Class C felony. So it's like a $10,000 fine, 5 years in prison if you happen to have one of these things. I don't necessarily need to talk. Well, yeah, let me just play. Griffey says that the legitimate drug manufacturers have these machines, and there's no reason why anybody else should have one.
There is no reason for somebody to possess one of these other than to deceive the public into believing they're taking a drug that is well-regulated by the FDA.
Yes, it's like guns. They are good in the hands of good people and bad in the hands of bad people. So they need to be taken away from the bad people.
Yeah.
Was that controversial in any way?
No, not at all. In fact, it passed the House 95-0.
Excellent.
And it is expected to basically do the same in the Senate. It'll take effect. And then again, it's just police are saying it's just another tool to go after somebody who's producing these pills. And as you know, Dave, if you just make one fentanyl pill, that's enough to kill somebody.
Exactly.
And with all the markings on it that look legit, or Percocet or any other oxycodone, you know, that any other encapsulated pill or hard pill, these machines can create them and make them look exactly like the one you would get at a pharmacy.
Cairo News Radio's Matt Markovich. Thank you, Matt.
You're welcome.
Your Daily Dose of Kindness, now sponsored by Robert W. Baird. It's not easy being Eric Kilburn Jr. The Michigan 14-year-old is 6 feet, 10 inches tall. His feet, size 23 and growing. And there's his problem. As of right now, his parents can only find size 22, which is painful for Eric to wear.
It's been impossible. My parents have called every shoe place you can think of. They've called them, like Nike, Reebok, Adidas, just nothing. They've led to nowhere.
So his parents turned to local reporters who got his story out. And it's not just style or comfort either. Wearing shoes too small for your feet, whatever the size, can result in serious complications. According to HomeLife.com, Eric has undergone 6 painful procedures to remove ingrown toenails. Eventually, he had to permanently remove the nails of his 2 big toes. He also sprained his ankle playing football for his high school, which may have been preventable had there been cleats his size. He's forced to play in his one pair of size 22 sneakers instead, a size too small. His parents hit dead end after dead end reaching out to major shoe companies. Nike said the only way they'd have a pair of size 23 shoes available is if they were custom made for a professional athlete who then returned them. It left Eric feeling isolated. Growing up as big as him, it took some time to adjust.
It was a weird experience realizing, like, oh, I'm going to be stuck like this forever. Like, I'm never not going to see the tops of shelves in a store. I'm never not going to see, like, the top of people's heads wherever I go. It was like coming to terms with it, I guess.
Ultimately, he's fine with it, but he still does need those shoes. Well, you guessed it. Once the story aired, companies perked up. Among the companies offering to help Eric, Under Armour and Puma, both of which have already scheduled representatives to come to him and begin fitting him for shoes. One company even making him custom cleats.
7:49, Seattle's Morning News. And now from the Gene Ursula Show, here is G. Scott.
Morning, bruh.
So I'm not on TikTok.
Oh, okay.
Not sure what I'm missing.
All right.
Are you on TikTok?
Yes.
You must be on TikTok.
Like, actively?
No.
Okay.
No.
But you're on it. You know.
I'm on it. I know. I'm with the hip, the in crowd.
Yep.
Right?
No, that's for clear. That's for sure. Yes.
So, look, my man, what's his name? One of the heads of TikTok is going to be, he should be doing that right now,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
He is before Congress. I came with some stats for you guys. The average age of an American here in the United States is 38 years old.
That's me.
Yay.
I'm average.
38 years old.
I always wanted to be average.
So 38 years old. Now, the average age of members in Congress, 58.4 years. The average age of senators, ready?
Yeah.
85.
No. 64.3 years.
Okay.
Oh. Now, somebody's listening, like, well, where is this coming from? When I see and have seen tech giants get asked questions over the years about, hey, so the internet and social media and Facebook and all this stuff, you can always see the boredom on Mark Zuckerberg's faces and all of these folks' faces, because they're like, you're trying to ask me tech questions, but you're going to go home and need your grandson to help you change the font on your cell phone.
Yeah, they need to stop asking tech questions, because really what they're trying to do is protect the national interest. It's not so much about how do you work this thing. It's, hey, China, you've kind of got a stronghold on this thing and our American teens are addicted to it. What are you doing with that data?
Okay, let's just be simple. And by the way, I got the stats on that as well, on who wants TikTok to be banned. Overall, U.S. adults, 41% support the ban, 25% oppose the ban, and 34% not sure. Of the daily TikTok users, 17% support the ban, 54% do not support the ban, and 29% don't care.
That's like asking alcoholics during Prohibition, do you want alcohol ban? We're addicted to we're addicted to social media. Of course they're going to say no.
So if we're going to keep it a buck here, and we're going to talk about the national interest and what's best for this country,
mm-hmm.
How in the world did TikTok, owned by over there in China, become a thing here on U.S. soil? It should have never been a thing in the first place.
America first? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. support. No. Yeah, he did. Get rid of TikTok.
Oh, so you support the ban?
Yes. What are we talking about here?
But you're on it.
Yeah. I'm on it.
You feel so strongly about getting rid of it. Why don't you get off it then? I don't understand.
But again, yeah, I'm on it because of maybe peer pressure, maybe interest. Yeah. I don't really use it. Instagram and Twitter is my thing.
So in other words, you're saying, please regulate me because I can't help myself. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying that all of our information, all of our data is being collected by China.
Yeah, I know.
And American companies too.
But
I mean,
this is all you've given. China didn't knock on your door and rifle through your papers. You gave up this information voluntarily, knowing it was going to a company ultimately run by the Chinese government.
I know.
Okay.
I know.
But it, so sometimes we need the government to regulate.
So it should have never happened in the first place.
Okay.
So let's go back to where this all started. The average age of Congress right now is 58 years old.
So you're saying they didn't see it coming.
The president of the United... I'm not trying to throw age out here, y'all.
Yeah.
The president of the United States is how old? Right?
I don't know.
Old. 79?
Yeah.
Like, something like that. Yeah. All of these things that we're talking about... We have no idea because social media and the internet was not a thing, Dave Ross, when we were at school.
You want an old man to help you control yourself.
What? No, I don't. Okay. No, I don't.
That's what I'm hearing a little bit. You're throwing them under the bus for their age, but then you're saying, hey, you should ban it.
I'm trying to say the reason why the internet and social media and all of this has gotten out of hand in the first place because there was nobody safeguarding the best interests of here what's in our country.
Got it.
TikTok should never be a thing here right now. I don't know how long TikTok's been going, but it shouldn't even be a thing.
Okay.
All right. They're going to hash this out starting at 9 on the Gian Ursula Show. Earlier on the show, we spoke with Zach Despard of the Texas Tribune about his piece, which was headlined, "He Has a Battle Rifle." It was about the Uvalde incident where police waited to enter a classroom because they were worried about the gunman's AR-15. And that altered the response of police during the Uvalde school shooting. While Despard believes that this piece is not going to change the perception of the weapon in Texas, what about showing pictures of what the rifle did to those victims?
So as part of this investigation, we obtained the crime scene photos from the school, and we reviewed them in order to be able to accurately and clearly describe the types of injuries this type of rifle inflicted on these victims. We decided to, and there's a passage in the story that explicitly explains, like, okay, this is the type of wounds that happened. I think that we are still opposed to releasing the images themselves. Like, I understand the argument that you're making, but they are horrific and haunting.
Talk about that. I don't think enough people have seen, we restricted images of war for so long that we didn't even know how bad it was for soldiers. And here we are battling on our own country's land and people are going, yeah, but I like my gun and children are dying. What did you see?
This is the passage in the story. It says several victims lost large portions of their head. Bullets tore gashes as long as a foot. They shattered a child's shin, nearly severed another's arm at the elbow, ripped another's neck, blasted a hole the size of a baseball in another's hip.
They were in pieces.
Like I said in the story, like these are the types of wounds that are inflicted. And I mean, yes, I reviewed the photos to write that paragraph.
I'm sorry you had to see those photos. And I hope that your newsroom provides you help for that, because it can trigger symptoms of PTSD. Now, are lawmakers privy to these pictures? Do any Texas lawmakers take a look at these and still go, yeah, not moved?
Lawmakers have access to these photos. I can't tell you how many of them have looked at them. Mm. I can tell you that it is unlikely to change the gun debate in Texas. What I will say is there is a prevailing argument, not just in Texas, but in this case, like that, well-armed people, police, including private citizens, are going to be able to intervene quickly and stop shootings. And in the story, I'd included a passage from a speech that Senator Ted Cruz had given at the NRA convention in Houston 3 days after the shooting in Uvalde. And he had said, the only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. He had cited two shootings, the Sutherland Springs church massacre in Texas and the Uvalde shooting, both of which were ultimately ended by people who did intervene and shoot the shooters. But the point we made in the story is like 47 people were still killed in these two shootings.
Right.
So the broader question is like, at what cost, does that strategy play out?
Yeah, and do we want our schools to look like guarded prisons?
That's a question that Texans are going to have to ask themselves as they figure out what to do next if they are not interested in restricting access to guns.
Have you seen any change that would make it less likely for a Uvalde-style massacre to happen again?
In Texas? Well, yeah. I mean, we have the legislative session is going on right now. There are gun bills in the legislature, none of them will likely pass. There are some measures that are still sort of figuring out the details about getting more armed officers on campus or expanding the ability of teachers to carry weapons on campus, things like that. It's just they're still in the process of working that out.
And remind me, and just to be fair to those who also want to talk about mental health, and don't get me wrong, let's do a yes and here. Guns, yes, and let's talk about mental health, and let's talk about support for families. It doesn't have to be an either or. Was the shooter in the Uvalde school shooting severely mentally ill? Was mental health the reason he shot up the school?
First of all, thank you for bringing that up. There is no easy answer to mass shootings. And this story is about guns, but that is only one policy area. Investigators have presented, and nothing in the investigative files we have reviewed has said that this young man had a diagnosed mental illness. That doesn't mean that he didn't perhaps have mental issues. We just don't know. It could have played a role, but again, to your point, gun policy, school security, mental health, these are all areas where experts say we can have better policies.
I forget, was there any, what were the circumstances under which he bought the gun?
He had attempted to get family members to purchase him a gun before he had turned 18, which is the legal minimum to purchase a long gun like a rifle in Texas. In the 8 days after he turned 18, he bought two AR-15 style rifles and more than 2,000 rounds of ammunition, and then committed the shooting. So all of that happened in a very short window after he became eligible to purchase those things.
Who sold him those guns?
He purchased one online. He purchased one from a local gun store in Uvalde.
Did the guy at the gun store know him, or was he just a stranger who walked in and bought this military weapon?
According to the investigative files, the gun store employees did not personally know the shooter, no.
So do they care? It seems to me that at the very least, if we're not going to prohibit these guns, they should only be sold to people who are known to the seller and who are known to be of sound character, in good mental health, and have some training. Is that crazy?
I mean, there are many people in the story who express a similar sentiment. I mean, I think it's worth underscoring that almost all gun owners, including almost all people who own AR-15 style rifles, use them safely. The issue from a public policy standpoint is how do we do a better job of weeding out the very small fraction who intend to kill people with them, right?
Mm-hmm. Online sales seems to me should be absolutely prohibited. What's to stop, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, name your terrorist group, from just buying an arsenal and shooting up whatever they want?
Yeah, I mean, under federal law, you can purchase weapons online. You still have to pick them up from a licensed dealer. So, for example, the shooter
who doesn't know you and knows nothing about you.
Yeah, I mean, gun sellers reserve the right to not sell weapons to people. We had made this point in the story where we got the security footage from the gun store in Uvalde, and when the shooter went to pick up one of the rifles, the employee had sort of put it on the counter, and the shooter had picked up the rifle and peered down the barrel and put his finger on the trigger, which is really
no,
not what you're supposed to do. It's just one of those gun safety things where yes, the gun was not loaded, but you'd never ever put your finger on the trigger unless you were prepared to fire.
Now, where does the investigation go next?
There are plenty of investigations that are ongoing, and frankly, sometimes it's hard to keep track of all of them.
I bet.
There is still an outstanding question of whether the district attorney who represents Uvalde will attempt to criminally charge police for their inaction. I'm not sure how that will play out. She has been pretty quiet about that. The state police have wrapped up their investigation. They disciplined some officers. There are some questions about why they didn't discipline more of them, especially commanders. But I know that the families certainly in Uvalde are quite frustrated that, 10 months on, they still don't have some pretty basic answers as to how the police who responded will be held accountable.
Yeah. Zach Despard, who writes for the Texas Tribune, his piece is headlined, "He Has a Battle Rifle. Police Feared Uvalde Gunman's AR-15. Zach, thank you.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.